Hello, I'm Mel Morgenbesser. I'm a retired member of the faculty at the School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today I have the pleasure of talking with Professor Alfred Kadushin, Emeritus Professor of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about his life and about the many contributions he's made to social work and to social work education. Professor Kadushin joined the faculty of the School of Social Work in 1950. He officially retired in 1986, but he continued teaching at the school until 1991. He's the author of many articles and six important books which address some of the central concerns of social work practice and social work education. He's the recipient of many awards and most recently was named a social work pioneer by the National Association of Social Work in recognition of his major and long-term contributions to the field. His many contributions to social work continue today to today as he is working with his daughter, Goldie Kadushin, a professor of social work at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, on the fifth edition of his classic textbook, The Social Work Interview, which is a textbook that's been used for many years in social work education and in social work practice, both throughout the United States and throughout the world. It's really gratifying, actually, for me to do this interview because I know Professor Kadushin in many different ways. I was a student of his when I was a student at the School of Social Work in Madison in early 1970s. We were colleagues on the faculty, and since his retirement, we've remained good friends. Al, I want to welcome you, and I want to thank you for being willing to share some of the observations about your life and about the social work profession. Let me start, I guess, at the beginning and ask you, you were born in 1916, which is actually during World War I, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about your kind of formative years, about your family, and about some of your upbringing. So can you talk a little bit about your family?
Yes. I was born on the Lower East Side, which is a place where many immigrants came to for the first place of living. I was born, as a matter of fact, near the Henry Street Settlement. I don't know whether that has anything to do with my ultimate relationship to social work, but I lived there only a short time before we moved up to the East Bronx, which at that time was a step up in terms of living situation. And I spent most of my young years till the age of about 12 living in the Lower East Bronx, going to school there. For the most part, my early life was uneventful. I lived in a tenement house building where there were about 20 families, and each family had two children at least, so the streets were teeming with children of my age, and we spent most of the time playing in the streets, all sorts of games. Our parents were very busy in doing what they had to do to keep the family going. My father worked in the garment trade. Let me say something about my father to begin with. He came from Lithuania, and he left Lithuania during the Japanese-Russian War, and he left because he was in imminent danger of being drafted. And getting out was an adventure in and of itself because, to some extent, it was illegal. He finally did get out successfully, came to the United States, and had to learn a language, had to learn a craft. Before he left Lithuania, when he was about 19, he had worked in the mill, and there were a few mills in New York City, no opportunity to work in the mill. And so he entered into the garment trade, which was a very frequent way of East European immigrants to make a living. My mother was born in Poland, but near Warsaw, but she came to the United States when she was about 2 years old and actually went to elementary school in New York, so that she was more Americanized, of course, than my father. My relationships with my mother and father were generally rather formal. The amount of time that a family needed to keep a family going was tremendous. We had no other appliances. My mother did all of the cleaning, all of the cooking, all of the baking, all of the washing. And we had ultimately four children, so that she was busy most of the day from morning until late in the evening. My father worked, left the house early during the day, and didn't come home till shortly before supper, generally pretty exhausted. And so our relationships was generally rather formal. I had no question that they loved us very much, because all of their behavior indicated concern for us, you know. My mother was always concerned about whether I had enough to eat, whether I was well clothed, whether I was in any danger, and so on and so forth. But generally, I lived outside of the house. I would go to school, come back to school, throw my book bag in the corner, and go out and play.
Ask you about, you mentioned your siblings. Did you have a dinner time, a regular dinner time, where the entire family would sit down in a more formal kind of way?
We had a dinner time. And generally, dinners at that time were rather large. My mother always had an appetite. She had an appetizer. She had a soup. She had a main course. She had a dessert. It was always a big deal. Mm-hmm. And there were four of us at that time. I had an older sister, myself, a younger sister, and a younger brother. And that was the time that we got together to talk and go over events of the day and so on and so forth. But the time of living in the street is the thing that was more formative for me, because most of the day I was interacting with peers. We had a whole series of games that we played. Ringolivio, Chase the White Horse, Johnny Anapona, 1, 2, 3.
Did you lady, play stickball? Or was that later? Stickball at all?
Stickball.
Stickball.
Stickball. That was the only athletic we played. We played indoor baseball also, but mostly stickball. Mm-hmm. And there was very considerable interaction between ourselves, kids, all of whom were about my age. I wasn't a particularly good athlete, but I was good in school. Mm-hmm. And within the group, I was accepted, but I always picked last when they were choosing
up for sides.
That's right.
Right.
But when discussions were, when we were discussing something, people will often say, well, what do you think, Al, you know, as though deferring to me. And my school experience kind of validated that. After I had been in school for, I think, the third or fourth grade, I was selected for a very experimental program, the Dalton Plan. The Dalton Plan was a plan where you operated mostly on your own. Mm-hmm. You picked up, we had some classes, but then you picked up a contract in the various subjects. You worked on completing the contract. You then submitted the contract to the teacher, who went over the contract with you, and then you picked up the next contract.
So was this elementary school?
It was an elementary school. Okay. It was called the Dalton Plan.
Does it have anything to do with the Dalton School in New York, which I remember is a well-known private school?
That's right. It's an not an extension, but an offshoot of that. Mm-hmm. Being chosen for the Dalton Plan, said openly to yourself and to your peers that you were doing well in school. Mm-hmm. And this was in line with the emphasis that my father presented in all of his discussions with me. Among the Jewish men then, athletics was for bums, The more important thing was school. And my father would very carefully go over my report cards regularly, bit by bit, so on and so forth, in addition to the subjects they had, reports on deportment, which was behavior.
Right.
And my father did that with all of the children. The question of, did you do your homework? Have you done your homework? Will you do your homework? were the kinds of questions that were asked.
Did your father have formal education at all, Al?
No. My father learned English. I have to admire my father very, very much. To come to a country, to learn a new language, to develop skills in a trade, my father used to go to lectures in English, and listen carefully. He went to a night school where they had English language, instruction. He tried to speak English to my mother, who spoke English very well, but much of their interaction was in Yiddish, But his emphasis was always, there was no question that we were going to go to college and needed to be good in school in order to be able to enter college. He examined the report cards of all of the other children in the family. There's a story that my sister came home crying, and she said to my mother, who asked her why she was crying, that she got an F in something. So my mother said, let me look at the report card. And she looked at it, and it said her name and her her address. And then it said gender F.
So she thought she failed gender.
Yeah. She didn't know what gender was. But there was an F on the report card. But this was indicative of generally how important the report card was to the family,
So your early history, your support from your family and everything really paved the way for your kind of later education and later commitment to education.
Yes, there was no question of that. We never debated, and it worked out. All of the children in the family ultimately did go to college.
Okay.
But that was the nature of the emphasis on what was important, significant, a matter of concern to the parents, and the way of pleasing the parents by bringing home a good report card.
One of the things you mentioned earlier that I want to get back to, because I think it's so different today, is you described just bunches of kids playing in the streets, hanging around, spending large amounts of unsupervised time.
Yes.
And today, of course, we hear much more about kids being structured times.
Yes.
So what accounted for that? Were you safe? And was that just a norm that it was fine to just go out and play for hours on end by yourself?
Well, you had no option. Your mother wanted you out of the house. If I was in the house, there was no question I was going to get into a big brawl with my sister. My mother would have to stop what she was doing to intercede and so on and so forth. She wanted us out of our hair. But it gave us a tremendous sense of freedom. We got into all sorts of troubles, I might say. I don't want to detail them, but nevertheless, there were occasions where people reported to my father of something I did, and so on and so forth. Just to give you a flavor of some of the things we did, across the street from the house, there was an A&P. A&P was the that time Sentry.
Right.
And they put out all of the fruit out in on the street, you know. And what we would do was you take a kid's cap, you throw it onto the potatoes, and the kid said, "Raise a little hat." And he went to grab his hat, and in the meantime, he grabbed potatoes when he picked up his hat. And then we would burn the fire, we could make a fire, burn the potatoes until they were black. Yes. And that was very delicious.
Let me ask you about the socioeconomic status of your family. Were you poor?
Yeah,
were you middle class?
This is another aspect of the family. My father was a cutter. A cutter is one of the most skilled aspects of the garment workers. A lot depends on the cutter. If he doesn't cut the cloth in terms of the pattern, the cloth is ruined.
Mm-hmm.
He was a member of Local 10 of ILGWU, International Lady Garments Working Union. The paper of ILGWU, Justice, was a frequent paper that we read and reread and reread. The orientation of the ILGWU was socialist. David Dubinsky, who was the head of ILGWU, International Lady Garment Workers, socialist. And so the atmosphere generally was left socialist, mm-hmm. social democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was a very avid member of the union, so on and so forth. And at that time, the wages of a cutter were really fairly decent in terms of the wage scale, even in the garment industry.
Right.
So that we had to be very careful about, you know, how we used money. But we never, when I was growing up, were concerned really about the fact that the family would be able to make it, pay the rent,
okay.
and so on and so forth. The other aspect that my father represented was a secular orientation to Judaism. We were Jewish, there was no question about that, but my father was secular in his orientation. He didn't belong to a synagogue. He rarely went to a synagogue. As a consequence, although I was circumcised, I was never bar mitzvahed.
Oh, I see. And was that orientation at that time common, or were you kind of different than other kids because you didn't go to Hebrew school or something?
Yeah, it was not common, but it wasn't uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the street and the neighborhood I lived in had a quasi-secular orientation,
okay.
you know. What was very clear on the various holidays, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, Purim, Chanukah, was that the neighborhood stopped
mm-hmm.
and no kid went to school. They used to take a census of how many Jews were in New York by the number of kids who didn't go to school, you know.
During the Jewish holidays.
On the Jewish holidays.
Right.
And if you bought clothes at any time during the year, you never wore them until the first Jewish holiday.
Okay.
That's when you were allowed to wear them.
I see.
So it wasn't unusual, and I never felt a sense of difference as a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't come up much in our daily play.
Right.
We didn't play Jewish, so to speak.
Right. You mentioned the socialist orientation of the newspaper of the Garment Workers Union and your exposure. So do you think, were there other things that you think later on were going to pave the way for you entering the social work profession at
yes.
all?
But let me get to that.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that's true. But in the year, there was a number of things that solidified on your identification in a number of different ways. One was this socialist left orientation. The other was I was secular in terms of my orientation, Jewish. The other thing was I was definitely identified as a Jew. The neighborhood was Jewish. In New York City then, we had four different enclaves. We had an Italian enclave, we had a German enclave, we had an Irish enclave, we had an Italian enclave.
Jewish enclave.
Yeah, and we had a Jewish enclave. Right. And all of the people, and the preponderance of people in our neighborhood were Jewish. The signs on the stores were in Hebrew. The papers that people read were Yiddish language papers. The voices in the street were speaking Yiddish. If you went out of the neighborhood, there was a danger that you might be accosted. And on occasion I was. Once we were in the Irish neighborhood and a group stopped us and they said, "What are you? What religion?" I said, "Catholic." And I said, he said, "Recite the Eucharist." And the game was up. So that was from others as well as from yourself, there was a recognition of the identification as a Jew.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. No, I was wondering with that, what do you think contributed to the early interest in social causes or?
No. I knew nothing about social work, never heard social work. Social work, one of the difficulties of social work, it's not a visible profession or occupation. Mm-hmm. Unlike a teacher, you always have contact with teachers, you have contact with doctors, have contact with dentists, but you never saw a social worker. I never did. Okay. Never heard of social work. Okay. It did, ultimately, and I'll get to that a little later. Yeah. No, because of my identification with Jewishness and my identification with myself as not athletic, but more likely to be academic, mm-hmm. is where my strengths were. When I got to be a little older, when I graduated from elementary school, I went to a school where they had RARB, that's rapid advance.
Okay.
You did 7A, 7B, and 8A, 8B in 1 year. But the school was at a distance from my house, and you couldn't go home for lunch, so I had to eat lunch at the school, which kept me once again in contact with peers rather than with the home,
I see.
And so on and so forth. But that once again solidified an image of myself as concerned with books, with discussions, and so on and so forth. And then, at this time, I got involved with a Zionist organization, Hashomer Hatzair. That means in Hebrew, the guardians of the young. Hashomer Hatzair is a left-wing Zionist organization that sponsored the kibbutzim in Israel. This is before the state was established. They established kibbutzim, which were very left in orientation. Everything owned and the kibbutz owned in common. Children didn't live with their parents. As soon after they were born, they lived in a communal nursery. Men and women worked the same jobs. The slogan was for women, biology is not destiny, you know, which indicates.
Yeah, that's quite a.
And that was part of the discussion of the youth movement. Hatzmer Tzeir was the youth arm of the more general left Zionist orientation.
Okay.
And we had a small house where we met. We discussed books, we discussed socialism, we discussed Zionism.
Now, is this when you were in high school?
This was when I was shortly after I graduated from junior high and in high school.
Oh, okay.
And most of this time was in high school. Mm-hmm. And we met and we sang songs. Shom ba'eretz chemdat ovot titkayev no kol hatikvot. We will go to the land of our fathers. Techezakno yedei kol acheinu amchoninim. Strengthen the hand of all of the brothers who build the land.
Okay.
I'll sing you a love song.
Were you drawn to the group because it was a group of peers initially, or was it the philosophy, or how did you get involved in this group?
I don't remember how I got involved, but it was consonant with my identification as a Jew, as a socialist. It all came together. Okay. These were all elements that were consonant with each other. So I was comfortable with the group.
Okay.
We danced the hora. It was also, from a social point of view, very good.
It was a fraternity or a sorority.
Since
we're talking about this time of life, this was also around the time of the Depression.
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about how that all, what your experience was like in the Depression, and how that all fed into who you are in your development?
Yeah. I graduated from high school, from junior high. No, I graduated from high school in 1932, right in the middle of the Depression, when it was worse, you know. Unemployment rate was 25%. You know, we talk about 10% unemployment rate as a catastrophe. Unemployment rate was 25%. Any job you went to, there were thousands of people lined up. And I was entering the labor market at the time.
Right.
For my father and the family, the garment industry collapsed. No work. You couldn't get a dime's worth of work. So my father either borrowed some money or had some money. We opened a mom and pop grocery store. And that took back-breaking work. It was from 6 in the morning when we had to prepare to open and so on and so forth till 10 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in the grocery store, my father worked in the grocery store from 1932 to about 1935 or 6. And I went to school at night. I went to City College at night, all during that period of time. Mm-hmm.
So it was still important for you to go to school,
even though
you were working many hours. And
my father insisted. I was needed during the day because there was a lot of hard labor involved in running a grocery store.
Right.
I don't want to go into the details, but it really required a lot of labor. And during the day I was very much needed, but at night when things were a little easier and all of the things had been arranged, my father insisted I go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to City College. And I tried to find a job. The orientation, people who lived through the Depression were in some sense scarred. And I live with it even today. First of all, you're very cognizant of money.
Mm-hmm.
You're very knowledgeable of the importance of having some money to keep you alive. We didn't have health insurance then.
Right.
You got sick, you were in bad shape. When we opened the grocery store, it was a very difficult kind of business who was always on the edge of collapsing, you know. But the idea was to get a secure job, not a job,
uh-huh.
a secure job. So everybody that I knew, including myself, would look for a paper called The Chief. The Chief was published every Friday, and it listed all of the civil service jobs.
Okay.
You got The Chief, and you knew where to go to get an application. So we got applications for everything. The sanitation department, I was on the sanitation department list.
Uh-huh.
Clerk grade one, clerk grade two, post office. Post office opened up and thousands of people came. And I was among them. Post office, that's steady. It's a good wage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You got a life to live.
So your father, even though you needed you in the store, this would have been more.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The store was not doing very well.
Right.
We were always just a little ahead of paying the bill.
So he was very supportive of you
looking for a
steady job.
I got the job in the post office.
You got the job.
Okay. We had a big celebration. I was very high on the list. And, that's one of the things about civil service. It's non-discriminatory, you know. There was no question of anybody could make an application.
Mm-hmm.
When I got the job in the post office, the world opened up, no. And I got the job in the post office. I'm getting close to social work, stick with me.
I got time.
Get a job in the post office, and they asked me whether I want to be a clerk or a letter carrier. And one of the things that is also part of my identification, I cherish autonomy. And so if you're a letter carrier out in the street, nobody's bossing you and so on, I said letter carrier. So they sent me to a station in Harlem, deep Harlem. There's nobody within blocks with a white face. And in the station, 90% of the people are Afro-American, but middle class. The earliest middle class black Americans were in two places, Pullman car porters,
mm-hmm.
which was, had a very good union, and the post office.
Interesting.
The guys in the post office had passed the test, so they were educators, they were attorneys, they were accountants, but couldn't find work. So here I was in a totally African-American neighborhood with a totally African-American working force. And that brings me to close away. I lived in a neighborhood that, for the most part, was a neighborhood that was, you know, not affluent at all.
Right.
There was only one section that was reasonably affluent. But most of the people were on their uppers. Most of the people were unemployed. Most of the people were struggling. And most of the people were finding it very difficult to make a living. The whole neighborhood reeked of discrimination, depression, you know, difficult living situation. And I was on the same route, walking the same buildings for 6 years.
In Harlem?
In Harlem, in the same area.
Right.
And I knew after a while almost everybody in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also then more aware directly of the living situation of most of them. Now, to some extent, some of a precursor of social work was involved in what I was doing. Very often, the letter carrier is the last link in news, see. I would be delivering letters, and there would be a lady sitting next to me, and she was looking to get a letter, and I passed the letter on to her. And she looked at me and says, "Oh God, I've been looking for this."
Uh-huh.
And she grabbed me. You know. And sometimes I deliver a letter, and the person will look at it and say, oh.
Yeah.
And the letter was an indication that she took the Wasserman test and she had syphilis.
Hmm.
And then she started to cry. And there were letters of people who had been traveling, and people were waiting for letters from right. them, and when they got the letters, they were joyous,
right.
you know.
Right.
It was, when I handed the letter, it was an illustration of a helping gesture, and the response, in many cases, it happened frequently enough, so, you know, I got a sense of it. A response that was a response to an event that was very, very meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I also learned a lot about the black African-American situation, because the guys around me were always talking about their life. We had three groups. We had blacks from the North. I have to say blacks, because always we talked about blacks. Blacks from the South, but blacks from the Caribbean. In
mm-hmm.
status, the Caribbean blacks were high status
okay.
because they had achieved their freedom on their own. Not that the American blacks who had to wait for the Civil War. The lower status was Southern people who came up from the rural South. And the discussions were around the differing living situation that each had experienced, and it was quite different, you know. And all of that
It sounds like, because you said you were one of the few white people in that.
Yeah,
and it sounds like you were reasonably accepted, or you were part of the group to some extent, or you
Well, at first I wasn't accepted.
Mm-hmm.
They were very diffident.
Mm-hmm.
Their experience with whites was that you had to be very, very careful and so on and so on. And they didn't know me, you know. There were some other whites, but most of them were clerks. But all of the carriers except myself, one other guy was white.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, since I was there 6 years, we spent a lot of time what's called boxing up. You know, you put the letters in the order that had to be. We made three deliveries a day, two in the morning and one in the afternoon. And so we were engaged with each other while we boxed up, which was a mechanical gesture, and we talked
and
so on. After a while, you know, they got to accept me and they were freer about what they said. And in the end, they used to say, stick with me for a while, they used to say, we're going to try to teach you how to act nigger. That's what they would say. How I could act like I'd be more of one of them, and that's what they used to say to teach me. I wasn't sure what they meant, but I knew to some extent it was a way of their making me one of them.
Okay.
But here was a whole education in social dynamics and social oppression and social discrimination and living in a group that was different from the ones that I ordinarily experienced. It was a different world. And all during that time, I was going to City College in the evening.
Okay.
We had, during the day, a two-hour swing. You did two deliveries in the morning, and then you had 2 hours where the mail accumulated for a third delivery, and we had a swing. At that time, I used to do my homework in a two-hour swing. And it was a wonderful job.
Yeah, it sounds like it really exposed you in many different ways.
And at that time, the neighborhood, also, it wasn't only what went on inside the post office in contact, it was what went on in the neighborhood. At that time, Father Devine was he was what is now Farrakhan. Father Devine had a big following in the neighborhood, and they used to have open meetings. And Marcus Garvey was Back to Africa Movement.
Right.
They had meetings, they had speeches and so on and so forth. And all of that was open to me as I walked through the neighborhood to where it is I had to deliver. So that in addition to what went on within the station, what went on in the streets was another education in a different world.
You know, the streets play a large role in your early upbringing in many ways. The streets with your kids and peers.
Yes.
And kind of in large groups of people, and the streets here. So it's
That's right.
And nowadays you don't think of people, I think, of relating to the streets in the same way, shape, or form.
Yeah, because the houses that people lived in were generally very crowded. They had to double up, they had to have tenants. There were some places where the bed was rented to two different people. Mm-hmm. Somebody had a day job, they used the bed. Somebody had a night job, they used the bed. And so, and people didn't live so much in the tenements because they were uncomfortable. They lived on the streets, which were more comfortable.
Right.
They congregated in
mm-hmm.
the streets.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. In summertime particularly, it's hot, you know, it's humid. The streets, if you slept on the fire escape,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, you were in school during this time for a long period of time over in college.
Yes.
And so what did you study in college? What interested you?
Okay. I'll go back to my father. One of the things that a matter of great concern, not only did you have to go to college, you had to get into a free college. We couldn't pay for the college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very competitive. City College was no tuition, absolutely zero tuition. It was very, very competitive. And so unless you had very, very good marks, it was very difficult to get in. And my father was very aware of that. He not only wanted you to go to college, but if you're going, you had to go to a college. But he didn't have any money to pay. My sister went to Hunter. Hunter was the women's college of City College.
Right.
See? So most of the people who went, and particularly in the evening session, were people from the working class. Fathers were garment workers, or they were furriers. Furrier was another trade. Carpenters, painters. Italians were in the garment trade. Irishmen were in the construction trade. And so most of the students who went to City College had their fathers in these trades, working class, union oriented. And City College at that time was what was Berkeley in the 60s.
Okay.
There were very heated debates among students, always on the left. There were no Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
There were two heated and fervent left group cliques. One was the YCL, Young Communist League. The other was YPSL, Young People's Socialist League. And they debated Stalin and the Soviet Union and the famine in the Ukraine and the Gulag and the Moscow trials. Endlessly we debated and competed. And every week we had leafleting, you know, to the students. And every week there was a demonstration. The place was a hotbed of socialist, communist left activity.
Mm-hmm.
And in these debates, you honed your political what should I say, competence and so on and so forth. It was a educational self. And I majored in history. I wanted to be a history major. I wanted to be a history teacher. My sister was a biology teacher.
Okay.
At that time in high school. And I wanted to be a history teacher. Steady job, mm-hmm. good salary, some status, and so on and so forth. And it was American history after Civil War. That was my major. Yeah. And the teacher, and this is, brings me to the bags, the teacher I most emulated was a history professor called Phil Foner. His son is now a very eminent professor at Columbia University, Eric Foner. And he would come to class with a cart, library cart, you know, mm-hmm. with books. Never came to class.
So he just would roll in with yeah. a cart.
He come to class and always would reach underneath for a book at the bottom of the library cart. And he was a delight to listen to, and he was left in orientation once again, mm-hmm. you know. He was a very, very good teacher.
And I think what you were saying about your own briefcases, because I don't know if we mentioned that yet, but as a student, I remember you walking into class.
Yeah.
I think we have the briefcases
yeah,
over
I was following
there
Phil
with two big briefcases full of books and reaching in and always having a sighting, having a book, a little note card that you would look at and read from. So that came, that was a progression, if
yeah,
you will.
Yeah, it really was. Yes. You know, I was in a measure emulating him because I admired him for the scholarship that was involved, his careful effort to document, you know, his assertions that he was making. Mm-hmm.
And you know, that really has stayed with you through
oh,
your
yeah.
life. When I think about the books you've written on child welfare, the books on interviewing and supervision,
right.
they're not only books which provide practice knowledge,
yeah.
practice, but they're extraordinarily well documented and well researched.
Yeah. It comes out of that. All of this that I'm describing, a measure stays with you, you know. But the other thing was, let me finish
sure.
there. That was another source of what made me this experience at City College, which emphasized once again our kind of my socialist left orientation. My attraction to scholarship and books generally, identifying myself with interest in intellectual activities and mm-hmm. so on. And so I stayed with the post office and I graduated from City College. I got a degree after 7 years in 1941 and in 1942. February or March of 1942, I went into the United States Army.
So that was in World War II, obviously.
World War II. Yeah. Pearl Harbor was December 1941. I was drafted in 1942. Mm-hmm. Finished City College, finished the post office.
So there was going to be no history teaching at that time.
Well, I had a...
Right.
A new life
a new
for
life.
4 years.
And you were in the Air Force?
No, I was in the Army for 4 years.
In the Army, okay.
Now, the Army also shaped me in the direction of social work, and I'll tell you why. I was in the Signal Corps attached to the Air Corps. We were in a Signal Aircraft Warning Unit. Our job ultimately was to go to Saipan after Saipan was taken over And we built a radar station on Saipan, aircraft warning. Our job was to alert aircraft, fighter planes, in case there was any incoming Japanese planes, using radar to detect their incoming. That was our job. And we built the radar station, established the radar station, and ran the radar station. It wasn't a particularly dangerous war for us, but nevertheless, we were involved in all of the raids from Saipan. Most of the heavy raids before we took Iwo Jima and Okinawa came from Saipan. 300 bombers at a time leaving the island for bombing Tokyo. And we had to monitor them so they didn't step on each other's toes, and so on and so forth. But then, when we took Iwo Jima, which was the next island closer to Japan, and we took Okinawa, there were no Japanese planes that we were in danger of going. So our job became somewhat superfluous. Mm-hmm. So the head of our unit calls me in, he said, Katushin, we're making you I&E officer. I said, what's I&E? He said, information and education. You have to, the troops have some time. We had 170 people in the unit. You have to lecture to the troops on material that they'll send us and why we fight, see? And other things that relate to problems that, you know, we're likely to encounter.
Why you, Al? Why did he pick you?
Well, I don't know why. I'll tell you why. I'm no good with my hands.
Right, I had a feeling.
All during my life, I didn't hold a hammer. When we came to Saipan, we had to establish not only the radar station, we had to establish living quarters. So they sent us Quonset huts that were dissembled, and we had to assemble them. And part of the assembly was you take the girders, and then you put a sheet of metal, and you have to hammer a nail through the sheet of metal into a hole in the girders. And if I had five nails, I missed the girders four times.
I understand.
So at last, the sergeant says to me, listen, Kadushin, you want to do us a favor?
Wait, we can't lose all these nails. We're losing a lot of nails.
This is what happened. There was a favor, go sit down. So when they had to pick I and E, they picked me. But here's the importance of I&E. I gave lectures, discussion lectures. It was mostly discussion. To guys that came from worlds I never knew, you know, rural South,
right.
Mountain states, construction workers, and so on and so forth. And I had to engage them in discussions of social happenings, you know, what they thought about this and that. And I was amazed at how the left doesn't know the working class. Mm-hmm. These guys were sharp. They were, you know, not entirely prejudiced, but they had a point of view that they could justify, even though it sounded prejudiced. At one time, and this surprised the hell out of me, the United Mine Workers in the United States went on strike during the war. See? And there was a big cry, how could you do it
right.
during the war?
Anti-American.
And that became a source for discussion. And I raised the question, how do they feel about the fact that the mine went on strike? And there was a big sympathetic, not a big, but enough sympathetic response. They said, the miners have a terrible job. It's a very dangerous job. They don't get paid. This is an opportunity to increase their pay. It was a very sympathetic response. So in many of the discussions, I anticipated reactions that really weren't in line with the reactions I was receiving. Mm-hmm. So once again, there was an education in a different world that I had previously been exposed to, a world that in some ways changed my attitude toward, you know, the different people in the community mm-hmm. whom I never knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting.
These guys, too, they had never met a Jew in their lives. There were only two, three Jews in our outfit.
So again, it's another example of getting to immerse yourself in a different culture.
That's
not
right.
Not because you chose consciously to do that, but because circumstances
that's
put
right.
you in another that, culture, and it opens right. up your worldview,
right.
I guess.
Yeah, it was a kind of chance. But nevertheless, it was an educational experience in terms of revising thinking with regard to social policies, and particularly with regard to my fellow Americans, you know.
How did you like teaching? Well, that seemed to be like the first formal teaching experience.
That's another thing. I found I liked it. I liked the discussion. I liked leading the discussion. I was more in my element there. See, in all of the discussions we had at City College, you're doing teaching too, in a way. You're talking to people and you're trying to express a point of view and you're trying to convince. So you're teaching them your point of view.
Right.
So a lot of things that I was doing, which involved the verbalization, ideas, conceptualizations, all of these things were part that I was living from Hashomer Tzair through a college, you know, and through the army.
But a big difference now is the audience and actual differing views. And,
that's right.
You know, and
a broadened view.
A broadened view.
Yeah.
A broadened view.
And then I was discharged in February of 1946. So I.
Let's take a break for a minute.
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Good idea.
How are we doing in time? I didn't even.
We got 50 minutes.
We've got 50 minutes already.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have more time, or what's your guy's schedule?
I have another shoot school. That I have to leave.
Okay.
I wave my hands too much.
No.
Doing great. No, that we want some action. I think.
I got out of the army, and the post office, of course, held a job for all of the people who went into the army. I went back to the post office, but now I had to make a change in life. I was 28, 29. I had spent 4 years in the army. I was late in terms of getting a profession. I didn't want to live my life in the post office. And I was late in getting married and late in having children. So now my agenda, my principal agenda, was profession, marriage, children, you know? And the three things go together, you know? And so when I came out of the post office, when I came out of the army, I was looking to decide on a choice of profession. Also, I was concerned with finding somebody to go with. Before I went into the army, I had been going with somebody, but that ended in a kind of very tragic way, which is not relevant. So when I came out of the army, I didn't have any affiliation with any woman. And so I and four or five other guys I was very close to would go away every weekend to resorts, left-wing resorts, you know, 40, 50 miles from New York. I was the one who had a car. We would go, and the emphasis was to find somebody.
Hmm.
But these were less spring resorts. And once again, I'm emphasizing that because...
They were what kind of resorts?
Left wing.
Left wing, okay.
The people who went to these resorts were generally left in their orientation. And I'm saying that because the things that I did also kept emphasizing a political orientation.
Right.
We went to these resorts and we sang songs also. But we sang union songs. I dreamt I saw Joe Hill last night, as live as you or me. Solidarity forever. I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union. Avanti popolo, alla riscossa, bandiera rossa, bandiera rossa.
I wish we had some music, Al.
The subtext was women. And the group was self-selected because you knew you'd meet people with a somewhat
similar
orientation. And that's where I met Sylvia. Sylvia and we started to go together.
And she was from New York. Also, she was from New York. Also,
oh, she was from New York. But see, when I met Sylvia, I was thinking I had 4 years of GI Bill entitlement. You have a month for every month you spent in the Army, and I'm so attached to taking courses that I started to take courses, but partly because of Sylvia. I tell you, she lived in Greenwich Village on 8th Street right off 7th Avenue. NYU was about four blocks away. At that time, I was working I wasn't working at that time. But nevertheless, I was going with Sylvia, and I enrolled in courses at NYU. I'd take courses late Friday afternoon, stay with Sylvia, take courses early Saturday, stay the weekend in Washington Square Park. And once again, the orientation with scholarships, I felt comfortable in the lecture hall and so on and so forth. But now I'm searching for a profession. And I considered history once again, but I had to take ed courses, which I hadn't taken. But my sister, Miriam, who had been teaching in biology, she was a biology teacher, said, it's not such an easy job. She was somewhat discouraging.
A faculty job, is that what she meant?
No, she was a teacher.
Teacher, yeah. Oh, teacher right in the...
Yeah. High school teacher.
Right.
Biology high school teacher. Right. And she said, well, it's true that, it's a nice job in terms of security, but it really is a very difficult job. And then she said, you're in danger of not passing the oral exam, which is very rigorous. I have what's called a malocclusion. My lower teeth go over my upper teeth. Most people, upper teeth go over the lower teeth. And as a consequence, I have what my sister Mickey called, Mickey was, the name we call her, a sibilant S. She said, even if you pass the written exam, you come up for the oral exam, you may have difficulty.
That's pretty rigorous.
Yeah, but she had gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, she had difficulty with the oral. So she said, it's chancy. So then I figured law. But law in New York at the time had a bad reputation. They were shysters, they were ambulance chasers. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, I didn't feel secure in law. you had to get your own clientele
practice,
and so on.
Right,
I wanted a job in an organization. So then my sister Mickey introduced me to a friend of hers who was in social work. Never knew the guy. I never heard of social work.
Right.
So we met and we talked.
You really never heard of social work?
No. I didn't know.
You had no contact with a social worker?
No, never nothing. Before.
Okay.
No. No. It wasn't on my radar, so to speak.
Okay.
He gave me a copy of the Milford Conference, which was a very famous conference held in 1928 that laid out the future of social work, what social work should be. It was a very well-ordered statement of the potentialities of social work. Mm-hmm. Nobody hears of it now, but it's very famous at that time. And he said, it's a job that has very many positive aspects to it. It's a job that's likely to be secure and so on and so forth. He said, why don't you consider social work? And it was good because it was a 2-year program. Yeah, I was always conscious of my age now, how late in life I was in terms of getting settled. And my family was always after me, when are you going to get married? When are you going to get married? Oh, boy.
So education and marriage, they were like dueling needs here.
No, a single man at that age is what's called a loose cannon,
okay.
You know. Yeah. They're very great days, not settled. So anyhow, after I talked to this guy for some time, he was very clear about his choice. And so he was somewhat persuasive. I seriously began to consider social work, and I began to review the vocational material on different possibilities, including social work. Now, here's the difficult part. If I say to my family, I'm considering social work, they say, oh. If I say to my friends, I'm considering social work, they said, what are you doing? What are you thinking? They thought it was not an appropriate choice. And if you investigate it, and the vocational literature did investigate it, they said social work is a woman's profession. Demography, social work is a woman's profession. At that time, there were 70% of social workers women, 30% men, like nursing and librarianship and elementary education. It's identified as a woman's profession because demography it is. But not only that, the image of the social worker, nurturant, accepting, all of the adjectives that you assign to social work are feminine.
Mm-hmm.
You heard of Lady Bountiful. Nobody ever heard of Lord Bountiful. And people were somewhat discouraging.
Right.
And not only said, and I'm conscious of how much it takes to raise a family. See, all along I had been,
money,
Yeah. All along I had been involved in budgeting for a family. I was the principal wage owner. After we closed the department store, the grocery store, and my father had worked, but very intermittently. I was the principal wage owner. I had to figure rent, I had to figure utilities, and so on and so forth. I was conscious of how much it takes to have a child, raise a family. And the salaries, as I investigated, it was always behind what males in comparable educational attainment. Mm-hmm. Bad. So that was very discouraging.
Yeah, I could see that.
And to some extent, I had to resolve that. I had to resolve the fact that I had to come to grips with the fact that my male identification was not consonant with my proposed occupational identification. Mm-hmm. They were in clash with each other. They were dissonant.
And the male identification sounds to be several things. One, it seems to be just the profession itself, which was female identified. The other was the ability to be the wage earner.
That's right, which is male.
Right.
Yeah. You're talking about 1950, you know, before the feminist revolution and so on and so forth, where gender roles were more clearly defined and accepted, you know. You're going to be married, you're going to head a family, you're responsible for bringing home the bacon, you know.
So how did you overcome those barriers, though?
The vocational literature said that one of the advantages of a male in a female profession is that he advances more rapidly. Later on, somebody writing about this said, women have a glass ceiling in the profession. Mm-hmm. Male in a women's profession have a glass escalator.
Interesting.
So, as I investigated this, you look toward the future, the possibility of advancing within the profession more rapidly than you expected and so on, to administration and so on.
Right. I want to stop you for a second because I think this also illustrates what I know about you and things you've said before is how carefully you actually research. I don't think most people, when they go into their careers, research the career that much, do the thinking about, but you really went to the literature, if you will, to think through these things and figure out how it was going to work.
No. See, the books are my support. Any decision I make, I go to the books.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody asked me what I would like at my epitaph, and I said, he died in the stacks of the library, chasing an esoteric reference.
I'm going to even stop you there because I remember a story, and we'll get back to your thing. I remember a story about that. I remember having lunch with you, I think after you had gone to China for the first time.
Yeah.
And one of the first things you did was get in the cab and go to the main library in China.
Yeah.
I always remember that story.
No. So, always look to the book. Sorry. Now everybody does the internet, but at that time, everybody did the book. So, but see, the attraction of social work for me is that it was concerned, as I have been for a long time, with social problems and discrimination and how people have difficulty in living under difficult circumstances and what it means in people's lives. And here was an opportunity to provide some kind of help, you know, in a way that would be and in line with my disposition and so on and so forth. You know, I cited before that my experience in the post office, where people would open a letter, that's really almost a social work paradigm, something that you say or do creates a period of joy for them, a period of help.
Let me ask, but how did Sylvia feel about this?
Sylvia's brother was one of the few male social workers.
Okay.
He ran a child, child residential treatment center in Yonkers.
Okay.
And that was another thing that helped me because he introduced me to other social workers who were his peers. All of them were women. So he had graduated from the New York School of Social Work, which was Columbia University School of Social Work. So I didn't have any trouble with Sylvia. Matter of fact, I never had trouble. But see, the image of social work, the left image of social work, see, it had an aura that was left of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So that was also consonant with the way I viewed the world. It was comfortable. But this really was not the deciding point. As I investigated social work and the development of social work, what social work in the United States was doing, stick with me, let me rephrase this again. Throughout history, people are doing social work. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning of history, people fall through the cracks. There are widows, there are orphans, there are disabled people, there are people who can't make it. And all during history, there was efforts to make, or the Bible keeps saying, the widows and orphans. So that all during history, there were people in the position of social work. If you go to Europe and you go to orphanages from the 1500s, orphanages that, in the language of Italy, it's called throwaway children or castaway children. But what happened in the latter part of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, was that social work, like many other professions, including law, which was previously apprentice, and even medicine, moved toward professionalization. So they said, we have amateur helpers, the friendly visitors, mm-hmm. but we need is a profession of social work where you develop a technology based on some science and based on some research that provides what the social worker needs to know in order to do an effective job. Now that attracted me.
Okay. See? So you saw it beginning to evolve into a profession.
Yeah. This is the way social work was evolving from the 1900s. I have a book here written in 1909 by Symington, How to Help. You know, laying out some of the techniques of helping. No longer a question of a nice person mm-hmm. Doing a good thing out of the fact that they want to do a good thing and be helpful. Somebody who's knowledgeable about what they're doing. So this is very attractive because it's scholarship in the end. It's developing the basis for the technology of a professional helper. And that's what attracted me. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'll go to school, which is beginning to teach that professional body of knowledge that enables people to help more effectively and more efficiently.
So yeah, I mean, again, it's quite a statement about your thought process to get, you know, a lot. Even now, when we ask people why they go into social work, they say because they want to help people.
Yeah.
And your evolution had come much more, it seems to me, around really thinking where the profession was at and the kind of excitement.
Yeah.
Of the profession starting to actually articulate.
Yes, right.
The science and the technology.
That's right.
Behind it.
And this is part of study, it's part of books, and so on and so forth. And so in that resolved, in accordance with the fact that I could possibly move up in the field so that the salaries would be better and the difference between my gender identity and my occupational identity would be not so sharp.
Right.
I said, I'll go to school of social work. So I enrolled in the school of social work.
In Columbia?
It was on the New York School of Social Work. It was in the Russell Sage building on 19th Street. It wasn't part of the Columbia campus.
Were there other schools of social work at New York at that time?
That's a very good question. I don't remember that there were.
So Columbia was like the...
Yeah. Okay. Well, nationally, it was the school of social work.
Right.
Yeah. No. And I also continued to take courses at NYU, but one course at a time, because I was able to be under the GI Bill. You got a stipend as well. Uh-huh. See, they pay for the course and you got a small stipend. Money was always an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Even while I was going to the New York School of Social Work, I worked at the Columbia, the Commerce branch of CCNY on 23rd Street as a veterans counselor.
Oh, interesting.
At night, right. From 6 to 10. We cleared all of the rituals for enrollment. We authorized books that the GI paid for. If you wanted to have your thesis typed, we authorized that. Mm-hmm. I was for 2 years while I went to school. So,
so you know, I can't help but think, you know, how important the GI Bill was to you and many, many people, and how now, you know, in 2009, we're starting to see a large group of veterans who will be able to retain and some actually very attractive educational benefits and how, how what that may do to education for the next decade or so in terms of allowing people to access education.
Well, I'll tell you. So I graduated from, here's what happened. I entered the School of Social Work, and I was dismayed at the level of scholarship of social work. The textbooks, you know, the instruction, the requirements of students. I said, you'll never make a profession out of this kind of activity. I mean, I said this to myself.
Mm-hmm.
As contrasted with City College, stick with me for a moment.
I'm
when I went to City College and I wrote term papers, I wrote, and this is also in line with my political orientation, I wrote a 60 or 70 page term paper on the activities against the left right after World War I. There were Palmer raids. Palmer was the Attorney General of the United States. He was like McCarthy. Not McCarthy, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah. There was IWW mob activities against IWW. There was.
I'm going to push you ahead because so you wrote a very extensive paper. It sounds like.
That's right. It was there was what was called the Soviet Arc. They deported many of the leading left wingers. Emma Goldman was one of those who were deported. There were five socialist assemblymen that were voted in for the New York Assembly. They refused to seat them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a whole series of actions during that period against the left. But I wrote a 60-page paper. I wrote a 60-page paper on something else as well, the Moscow trials. That was the kind of thing that at night was what required of it. I go to the New York School of Social Work. Mm-hmm. I get done with a 12-page paper that I'm not particularly proud of. And it's accepted, you know.
Now, of course, you know, many people at that time, you also had a practice component of social work.
Yes.
In addition to classes.
Yeah.
There was a pretty heavy expectation of actually spending yes. time and learning in the field.
Yes.
So it might have been a little harder to do that 60-page paper
yes.
and be in a field placement. But you found it just deficit in terms of...
Yes. The fieldwork program was the fieldwork program. But the fieldwork program is not theoretical in nature. The fieldwork program is practice in nature. But the theoretical part, the textbooks, the requirement, and I changed my target rather than going toward helping a practicing social worker. I changed my target to be a student of the social work profession. So when I wrote a thesis, we had to write a thesis then.
Right.
I wrote a thesis, I sent a questionnaire to graduates of school of social work, They had been in practice for 2 or 3 years. Said, what changes would you suggest in the curriculum of the school? I was concerned with what the school was teaching. Okay? I was then concerned with social work education.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, you didn't particularly, since you had this kind of not such positive view of the educational thing, you chose to move forward with it rather than just say, I'm in the wrong place, I'm in the wrong, you know, I should go back to history yeah. where the academically.
No. So I felt I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. See, time was so much of a matter of concern to me. That if I dropped this,
you'd have to start
with time
something.
Wasted.
The so you kind of redefined your goals.
Yes. I had to capitalize on the fact that I invested some time in it. The other thing is, once I graduated, I got a job to practicing social work. And that once again confirmed for me the fact that my training hadn't really prepared me for doing the job. I didn't have the skills that really enabled me to do the job comfortably. So that confirmed me in my idea that what I need to devote myself to, professionalization of helping is a very desirable objective. That then I would devote myself to the probabilities of increasing the effectiveness of what is taught for professional social work. Somebody graduated, having learned these things, we're in a position to effectively and efficiently perform what was required of them.
And did you at the time realize that this would likely mean you're going even on to school past the master's degree? Like when you were thinking about this, did you realize that's going to mean study it at a more advanced level than master's degree?
Yes, and that's what confirmed me by continuing on for my PhD. And I read all of the bulletin boards and all of the agencies that have had a teaching job in social work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was looking for. And continued the PhD. I got my PhD in educational sociology. There were no few PhDs. I don't remember that there was a PhD in social work at the time.
Okay.
But educational sociology had a counseling major.
Major, okay.
And then that was concerned with helping and psychotherapy, really.
Right. Let me take it back real quickly to some of the time in the master's program. So you found the academics, you know, wanting, if you will.
Yeah.
How was the field placement itself? How were your fellow students? What did you feel about them? Did you feel it were bright people, committed people? Was the field placement a useful experience?
Well, that was a bit disappointing, too. I had a fieldwork placement in a psychiatric hospital. how we had relatively few clients, so we had a caseload that was very limited. I felt that it was better than the coursework, but it wasn't scholarly. I always come back to that because it's so fundamental in all of my growing up and all of my experience, you know.
Right.
I'm looking for this. I want to see what the book says. If the book doesn't say anything, they don't know anything, you know.
But did you find other students who had a similar view? Because, again, it seems to me most people enter the profession because they want to use a skill and they want to help people. Were you kind of alone out there with this kind of somewhat dissatisfaction? Or were there other students who you kind of were able to...
I felt I was alone.
Could you talk about it in the school?
I must say that if I could certainly transport myself to that time, I don't know that I would have been able to articulate as clearly then as I'm articulating now.
Right.
I had these feelings that pointed in this direction, but I don't know. I don't remember that I discussed this with any students. I was very busy. I was taking the courses. I had this VA job at night, and then at weekends, I was doing public opinion polling. Always I had a little...
And you had a relationship. You had Sylvia.
We would go, if a new movie was coming out, we would go to the theater, and as people were coming out, we'd ask them what they thought of the movie, see? Mm-hmm. Each one, they would make out a little questionnaire, and we got paid for the questionnaire as to what they, I had that kind of job. So I don't remember that. I can't remember that I had much contact.
Let me ask you, and then maybe we'll stop in a little while, but at Columbia at that time, were there any faculty that you remember as being particularly...
See, that may have been the time, it was right after the war. The GI Bill also operated with reference to enrollments in schools and so forth. So they had increased enrollments, and they had to get people that weren't previously members of the faculty. You know, catch as catch can. So most of the people in the faculty, I didn't have much respect for.
So there was nobody that stands out for you at that time.
The other aspect of this, Mel, is that the orientation of social work toward social change didn't grab me. See, in all of the experience I had with politics, soured me on the left and the right. There was so much division, there was so much acrimony, there weren't party line recrimination. There was so much split. There were not only the socialists, there were the Shachmanites, there were the Luftzonites, there were the Trotskyites, all of us on the left. I saw the left, they'll never get ahead, and social work doesn't have any knowledge of what making these kinds of changes alike. You can't go back to Hull House. So that didn't interest me at all.
And was there, at that time in the School of Social Work, was there a social change focus? Was that the main part of the program, or was it much
social,
more?
No, it wasn't.
Right. So what was the kind of focus? Or was it more mental health or psychiatric care? Child welfare.
There's the patina, that's not a good word. The image.
The image, okay.
Which comes from Hull House, you know, and that group.
Right.
That we're going to make the world, and so on and so forth. The reality of the professional group was on technique, on how to. The Hull House books weren't much part of the literature of social work curriculum. They talked that.
Right.
But there was really no Hull House technology. They were in the question of helping one-to-one.
Okay. So there was, at that time, much more of an orientation of one-to-one, maybe small
what there
group
was, I know I'm going to talk to you. What there was represented by somebody called Edward Lindemann. I don't know if you know that
I've
name.
I've heard the name.
Yeah. He was in the faculty, the social change person. Mm-hmm. And when I heard Edward Lindemann, he was like my grandfather, you know. He was talking like, well, whatever it was, I didn't have respect for Edward Lindemann, but he was the one that they pointed to as the guru for social change.